sponsorship, loads of newcomers, and a willingness to surrender all my judgments and opinions on a regular basis. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since Halloween 1978, and for that I owe AA my life and my freedom. Good to be here. I am delighted to be here. This is my home group, even though the Saturday night meeting I don't get to as often as I'd like to. I seem to be gone a lot on the weekends. It's either do that or say no to things AA asked me to do, and I've been taught to say yes to whatever AA asked me to do. No matter how inconvenient, no matter how tiring, no matter how tedious, I just say yes. And if Alcoholics Anonymous has done in your life what it's done in mine, you would say yes too. You bet you would. I'd like to welcome the new people. I'm glad you're here. I couldn't get this for a long time, and I relapsed over and over, and I switched from alcohol to drugs, to other drugs, to back to alcohol, to combinations of alcohol and drugs, to I think I did everything except shave my head and chant Hare Krishna at the airport. I mean, I did just about everything I could to fix me, all kinds of therapy, every medication that was available, and I'm still me. And I could not buy the whole package of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I almost died of alcoholism because of one minor aspect of my personality. The same thing that almost killed me and prevented me from getting in here. Believe me, if I ever leave, it will be the same thing within me that takes me out. And it's that part of me that thinks it knows everything and is right about everything, right? One of our, there's a doctor who was very influential in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's mentioned in our literature, and he said one time that people like me, and he didn't even know me, but he knew me, he said people like me have an inability to listen to hear anything new. They can only listen to see how they're already right about everything, you know, and I was that guy. I was just that guy. I don't mean to be that guy, but I'm that guy. And I run critiques in my head over everybody, and I get resentments towards people, and the minute I get a resentment towards people, they can't say or do anything right ever again, right? And I'm sick, and I'm dying, and I don't know what to do. And if you would have told me to let go of all your old ideas, I was willing to do that. Not the ones that were right, but the other ones, which there wasn't very many other ones, really. Right? And as a matter of fact, the absolute most painful, worst years of my life were after I came to my first AA meeting. I came to my first AA meeting as a young kid. I wasn't even able to take a legal drink, and for the next 7 years, I was in and out of halfway houses and detoxes, and it was horrible. I had something happen last night that just really got me. Every once in a while, something gets down inside me, and I was at the detox, and there's a bunch of us sitting around. We were having a great meeting, and there was a guy in the alley down between the detox and the Samaritan house who was either coming off a drunk or on a drunk, and it was like he was crying, but he was more than that. It was like he was wailing, and his pain and loneliness and desolation just grabbed me, and I remember wailing all by myself like that, because all the people that had ever loved me, I had just crapped on them to the point where I was all alone. And I can never get that back. And it was too late for me. And I didn't mean to do any of that to any of those people, but I did. And I didn't know how to undo it, and it was too late. And I in 1978, I tried to take my own life. And I'm standing on a bridge. And this is after 7 years of institutions and 7 years of relapsing. And if you'd have come up to me and said, Bobber, alcohol, you're dying of alcoholism. I wouldn't have said alcoholism. You know what it felt like to me? It felt like what I heard in that guy's wail last night. It felt like I was dying of loneliness because I don't fit anywhere. Drunk and drinking has turned on me, and it's become pathetic and self-pitying and depressing. And I get sober, and I don't fit anywhere sober, and I'm a judgmental guy. It's pretty hard to be a part of when you're constantly picking people apart, right? And I was just as painfully alone and lonely when I was sober as I was when I was drinking. And that's not a good spot, because that means there's no relief anywhere. When alcohol and drugs stop doing the magic thing that it did for you when you were 20 years old, you know, and you know the magic thing, you wouldn't be in this room if there wasn't a time when the hook was set, if there wasn't a time when it lit you up and it was the best thing that ever happened to you. We all have those times where you go out with your friends and, man, 5 or 6 drinks, and you can talk to members of the opposite sex, and you can dance, and you're funny, and you can laugh, and you're free. You're free. Oh, that's what it felt like. I'd walk into a bar or a party just so locked up inside of me, and 4 or 5 drinks, and I was free. I could come out and play. I could talk to people. And for a guy who feels like he's dying of loneliness and doesn't fit anywhere, oh my God, what a tremendous thing that is. But alcoholism is a progressive disease, and that what that means is over the years, my ability to get that kind of fun and effect from drinking got less and less, and the problems got more and more. And I threw every drug in the mix I could throw in there. I did everything I could do. And I can't fix me. I like therapy. I like psychiatrists. Psychiatrists are always good for some interesting pills. I like pills. I've never met a pill I didn't like. I was the kind of guy when I was a kid, or even in my early 20s, that if I came to your house, I'd ask to use your bathroom. I'd go through your cabinets. I'd just take whatever was there. You know what I'm saying? I don't even know what it is. Sometimes I'd be up for days. Other times I'd be stumbling around. A couple times I'd get so regular, I mean, it would just be overwhelming. I don't think there's a chance I'm ever going to be pregnant. I mean, I just take whatever's there, right? Because I got this big hole inside of me. I've got this big vacancy, this desolation inside me. And I cover it up with a lot of cool. I cover it up with a lot of judgment. I try to pick people apart. I cover it up with all that bravado, that ego, self-centered, as the book calls it. It's the same thing, ego-centered or self-centered, same deal. Chuck Chamberlain one time said, if it wasn't for ego, we wouldn't even need AA. Oh, man, I'm telling you. That was my big delusion in the beginning, is I was going to surrender this thing once and for all. Yeah, that went 3 minutes. Yeah. Alcoholics Anonymous has protected me from me. There's only one person in this room that ever has issue with anybody in this room. There's only one person in this room that plays God. There's only one person in this room that separates me from you, and that's me. I am always been the seat of my separation, my judgment, my conflict. And yet, when you're really secretly like that, and you don't want to believe you're like that because the ego can't stand being wrong, I got to make it out to be you continually, continually, continually. And 1978, I'm standing on this bridge trying to take my own life, and I came off of that run here in Las Vegas. I didn't intend to come to Las Vegas. I was actually trying to get to California. I had done some things that were going to cause me. I was absolutely certain of going to prison for 2 years, and I was on the run. I had no place to go. I guess I was a homeless guy. I didn't really think of myself as homeless. I was kind of an urban outdoorsman in the Jack Kerouac spirit, really. But I was actually a homeless guy. I slept on people's couches and in halfway houses, and you know, I mean, I hadn't made a deposit on a rental, or I had no lease in my name. When my parents threw me out, wouldn't help me anymore. Gone with the Wind, I survived through the generosity of strangers. You know, I was that guy. I end up in a hospital here in Las Vegas, and some real doers in Alcoholics Anonymous that I came to love and still love to this day. A guy named Dick T, and another guy named Happy Jack, and another guy named Rusty. And they were the men and women who, they didn't just talk about recovery. They actually gave of their time and their attention with a consistency to go into places that guys like me end up. And if there's people in this room that do that and give of your time, God bless you. And I know I do that myself, and you do it, and you do it, and you do it, and every once in a while you catch one guy. We caught a guy this weekend. And he's on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. He wants this thing. And it doesn't matter if you need it. There's people dying, and I can take you to, there's parts of town here where you can walk down the street and see dozens of people. You look at, they're dying. They need this thing. Don't make no difference how much they need it. I could take you to people. There's guys over in detox right now that as they're checking in, they want it so bad they're weeping. And they'll never get it. It's only the people who do it. And it's the only fair place I've ever had, where I've ever been, where you get exactly, you don't have to measure up or merit this thing. You don't have to become good. You just have to devote your life to a lifestyle of continually trying to surrender your ego, yourself, and helping other people. None of us do it right. None of us do it perfect. But I have been able to survive myself here by a willingness to at least stay in the zip code of surrender. And that's what I got to do. I don't have to get there all the way, but I have to be the guy that when my head starts, oh, look at that guy, just look at the last 1,000 times I had thought that were wrong and went, every once in a while it gets my attention, I think I'm right again. Because you know what happens to me? Every once in a while you are right. You have a judgment about something, oh, that's right. But a broken clock's right twice a day. That doesn't mean you're right. I mean, you know what I'm saying? But what happens to guys like me? I got that kind of ego that just waits. Just, oh, he really was like that. See? Oh, see, you do know stuff. Oh, yeah, right? And it starts again, you know? It's crazy. So I ended up in this hospital, and these guys in North Las Vegas, I went to Southern Nevada Memorial Hospital, and they shipped me. They found out my father, who loved me but could not have anything to do with me. I broke his heart so much. But he worked for the government, and he kept me on his Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And then they ran my name, and they found out I had Blue Cross and Blue Shield. They shipped me over to this alcoholism deal at North Las Vegas Hospital. That's where I met Dick and Rusty and Jack and all those guys. And the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And I wish I could tell you, I wish I could express to you words that would make you set yourself aside enough to get something. But there is no words. There is no words that will allow someone to surrender that can't surrender. There is no words. But something had happened to me coming off that last run, and I think what really happened is I got to that place that it talks about in A Vision for You, where you can't live with it because it's turned on you. You know, and you start to get it. You may fantasize it's going to be fun like it was in the old days, but you start to get the truth. This is it. This pathetic, pitiful drinking and drug use is it. And you start to see that truth. And at the same time, I realize I can't live without it either, because abstinence feels like I'm doing time, and I put up with it. It's my emotions just put the grind on me, and I'm so depressed and uptight, and I just torque. My personality gets torqued because of everybody that's just out of line around me, you know. And I just get and I don't mean to be that way, but I am. And I can't kill myself. I'm on the bridge, and when it came time to jump, I chickened out. Tougher guy would have done it. I chickened out. And you know something? When drinking is awful and not drinking is awful and you can't even kill yourself, what the hell's left except AA, really? I mean, it's the last house on the block. I mean, where else do you go? I mean, it's you know, there's nothing else. I mean, this is it. Oh, yeah, this is the A&A again. Well, and I'm sitting in this hospital, and after they got the tubes out of me and I could get out of the detox portion and start. They had AA meetings in there, and I went there and I started. These guys that I was just telling you about were in there. And for the first time in 7 years, I could hear him. I don't know why. I wish I could tell you I got smart. I didn't get smart. I think what objectively, honestly happened to me is I was so demoralized, I got just enough of me kicked out of me that for the first time I could hear you. See, there's always been too much of me between me and you. There's always been too much of me between me and God. You know, from a little kid, they were telling me about God, but it's too much of me going on here. There ain't no room for nothing else. I don't like the idea of God, because I was learned as a kid that if there is a God, that's probably not good for me. It's he can see in the dark, which is bad for me. That's, you know, and he knows what I'm thinking. Oh, that's beyond any nightmare science fiction movie I ever saw. He knows what I'm thinking. And, you know, I can't. And I got too much pomp and too much me and too much. And besides, if there is a God, I secretly know he's got my job. You know what I mean? That really should be my position running the universe. Now, I couldn't have told you that, but if you'd have watched my feet and watched how I judged everything and let go of the wrath of Bob when people didn't do Bob's will and all the other stuff, you'd have seen a guy who was playing God. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I just, when you think you're right, why would you think you're playing God? Right? I don't think that. And one of my favorite AA speakers died years ago, Jimmy Williams, and he said something I loved. He said, the alcoholic's always the last one to know. Everybody around me knew before I knew. And if you're like me, maybe people have known stuff about you that you don't want to know. And maybe they've known it for a long time. When I was brand new, there was a guy, Joe Wright, and Joe was, I think he lives in San Diego, and I haven't seen him for 20 years probably. And Joe cornered me after a meeting one time, and he told me I had to take the third step, you know, which is turn your will and your life over to the care of God, which is hard for a guy who doesn't really believe in God or even suspects that if there was a God, it's probably not good. I mean, it's not a good deal. So I told him, I said, I can't do that. And he said, why not? I said, well, I don't really know if there's a God. He says, you don't have to believe in God to do step three. I said, Joe, it says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I don't understand God. I don't even know if there is a God. He says, listen, kid, that doesn't mean that you just turn your will and your life over to this chair. And he points at a chair. He says, if you'll do that, I guarantee you an instant miracle. I said, okay, I turn my will and my life over the chair. What's the miracle? He says, well, a miracle would be your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And we said that. I didn't even get mad. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yep, yep. Because if you'd have followed me around the last 3 years of my life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not talking about the knucklehead drinking behavior. What's even more crazy is the knucklehead sober behavior that eventually gets me back to drinking. If you'd have followed me around for about 3 years as me and watched me as possibly your family and loved ones maybe have watched you, it'd be easy to come to the conclusion whoever's making decisions for this person is out to destroy him. And yet, isn't it weird that inside me, that's the reality, that would be the consensus of everybody who knew Bob. But yet, inside me, where I live, I got this ego that just justifies and rationalizes everything, that defends and explains everything. There was a guy, maybe some people here might remember Dale. Dale was, he was real close to Louise Robinson. One time he ran a little halfway house up on Donna Street, North Las Vegas. But Dale was a great guy, kind of a gruff guy. One of those kind of AA members that in his eyes always smiled, but nothing else. It was a grim kind of guy, but his eyes always were smiling. He always looked like he needed Ex-Lax or something, you know? But he was actually a very happy guy. He was a really happy guy. He just had that light in his eyes. And he got in my face one time. He says, listen, kid, I want to tell you some things that'll save you a lot of grief. He says, kid, I want you to understand, when you're explaining something, when you're defending something, when you're rationalizing something, you're justifying something, kid, I want you to know you're wrong. because you never have to explain, defend, justify, or rationalize what's right. And my head blew up because I thought, oh, you don't know about the guy. You know, and I'm telling you, he was exactly right. Matter of fact, they say it a different way in the 12 by 12 in step 10, where they say it's a spiritual axiom, which means something true under all conditions. It's a spiritual axiom that when I'm disturbed at all, no matter what the cause, no matter how much I secretly think it's your fault, no matter what the cause, that there's something wrong with me. And that's a hard reality to get. You mean when I sit somewhere at work or in a meeting or in traffic and I see that you're an idiot and you're agitating me and it's really your fault, that it isn't really your fault? That it's me? No, not me. Yeah, it's me. It's always me. And I've reasonably happy and comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't just placate that. I know that. That's not something, that's not podium talk. I think it was for a long time here. But I really try to live that. I really try to live a life of a guy who doesn't know. And I fight that ego. And I fight, what I've come to understand is the root of my alcoholism, that alcoholic ego, that self-centeredness. It's the deal. It's why I do what I do. It's why I have the sponsor I have. It's why I have the guy, my go-to guys that I talk to. I need, that's why I sponsor people. That's why I go to detox twice a week and I go to the county jail. I need every single bit of it to protect Bob from the only person Bob ever has to be protected from, me. I need every bit of it, every bit of it. Now, not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous is like that. There are some people here that their alcoholism is kind of over when they stop drinking. And that's wonderful. It really is. I used to resent you for being that way. How come I got to do all this stuff? I got to tell you something. I think that my type of alcoholism very well may be God's absolute greatest blessing he would ever give one of his children. I heard a Catholic priest one time in a retreat say a blessing was anything that pushed you, shoved you, or dragged you screaming into being more than what you are. And I'll tell you something, my alcoholism, I would never have to have a sponsor that I have that has no respect for my feelings. I would never have to be inconvenience myself the way I have to do it on a regular basis. I would never have to look at me and see how I was wrong. I'd never every night have to see where I'd been selfish and trying to run the universe and be right, and where I'd been dishonest, and where I'd been self-seeking, where I'd been frightened and afraid of not getting my way, or afraid of what you think of me, or all the different 100 forms of fear. I would never, the secrets I've been keeping or that I should have discussed with another person at once, I'd never look at that stuff if I wasn't under the gun of alcoholism. You know, I've screwed up a lot in sobriety. But I've never got that far. And you know why, I think, is I've never lost my healthy respect for the disease of alcoholism. I never have. I haven't got perfect here, but I've never lost that healthy respect. You know, some people lose the health. When it says in our 10th step, it's easy to let up on this spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. If you're new, I'll tell you some good news and some bad news. And this is on the square. This happens to everybody. The good news, you work those steps, you get a sponsor, work those steps, get involved, help other people. In time, you're going to feel better than you've ever, your life's going to be better, you're going to inside and out than it's ever been. The bad news is that you get a sponsor and you work those steps, you get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, help other people, you're going to start to feel better than you ever felt. And that's the bad news, because as that happens, all of a sudden we find, guys like me, find ourselves in the driver's seat again. You know, and there's a false sense of security that comes with the fruits of recovery. It's so easy to start feeling bulletproof here. Like, oh, I'm never going to drink again. Do you know, I've in detox for the last, since they opened, I've been going, and even before they opened the other places, I went for 29 years. I've been going into places and I've been seeing guys that relapse every week. Do you know, I've never met one person yet, not one, that the week before they were going to relapse, ever thought they were going to relapse. I mean, when you think about it objectively, if they knew, oh yeah, by next week I'm going to ruin my life, you know, they'd do something, right? They never know. You feel bulletproof right until the key turns. Right until the key turns in your head. All of a sudden, it seems like a good idea. I can't tell you how many dozens and dozens of times, wonderful, wonderful men and women who had everything to live for. I watched them burn their life to the ground because they're seduced into a false sense of okayness by the fruits of their own recovery. And it's so easy to do that. And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the guy behind detox that's wailing and wishes I was dead. I don't want to be the guy again that I've been. And I've been that guy where I'm trying to think of a way to kill myself. This is a horrible disease. If it just hurt me, it wouldn't be so bad, but it hurts everybody I love. So by the time you get here, there ain't much left of you that you care about. And it's hard to save your own life when you secretly don't like yourself. And all you got's this big vacancy that you want to gratify all the time, and you really don't have enough respect for yourself to live by anything of principle, or because you got this hole. I understand that. I'm that guy. Tell you a little story. I've been thinking about this. Two and a half years before I got sober, right before I left Pennsylvania for the last, at that time, I was staying on a guy's couch. And it was getting thin staying there, but he was tolerating me. And I hadn't seen my mother and father for a long time. I want you to know that I love my mother and father. I didn't come from a bad home. I sponsor guys that were beaten and tortured and just abused. That was not my story. My mother and father loved me. They sacrificed for me. They would have done anything to help me. And I broke their hearts so many times that they were forced to cut me out of their life. Not because they didn't love me. It just was too painful. I mean, for God's sakes, my father got friendly with the guy who owned the only pawn shop in the town we lived in from buying his own stuff back. So the guy finally cut me off as a friend of my, as a favorite of my dad. At the end, my father slept 15, 16 hours a day. My mother took sedatives and went and saw a therapist. See, they could cut me out of their life, but they could not cut me out of their heart. And the vacancy that they must have experienced, I can't imagine doing that with my daughter. It would just destroy me inside. But they were forced by the pain of me in their life. And I'm on this couch, and I'd hustle. I had enough money to get a bottle of wine. And I used to come to on this couch sick. I'd sit on that couch and I'd grab myself, and I'd rock back and forth because I'm shaking, and I need a drink bad. And I got enough money to get a jug of Richard's Wild Irish Rose, and I'm going down to the liquor store, and I get the jug, and this woman that knows my family is there, and she says to me, she says, "How's your dad?" And I don't know. I haven't seen or talked to my dad in a long time. I said, okay, I guess. And she says, "Well, I heard he was dying." I didn't know he was even sick. I said, "I hadn't heard that." She said, "Yeah, I heard he's in intensive care in the hospital, and he may not make it." So I had just enough change left to make some phone calls, and I went and I called my mother, and I got her on the phone, and by this time, I'm nervous and I'm shaking and I took about a couple big pulls off this jug of wine just to get the medicine in me so I'm not vibrating as much, you know. And my mom gets on the phone. I said, "Mom, I hear Dad's in the hospital." She said, yeah. She's like, she has one of those, "What do you want?" attitudes, right? And I can't blame her, you know. Everything I did to them, I can't blame her. And I said, "I hear Dad's sick and he's not doing good." And she said, yeah, he's not. I said, "Is he going to be all right?" She says, "I don't know. It doesn't look good. He's in intensive care." And I said, "What hospital is he at? I want to go see him." She says, "Rob, you can't see him." I said, "You got to let me see him, Mom. He's my dad. You see, I had a lot of unfinished business with my father. And the idea that he's going to die and I don't get to say, tell him how sorry I was or even tell him I loved him is just like a knife right in the center of who I am, just twisted. And I can't, it's freaking me out. And I said, Mom, I got to go see him. She says to me, she says, Rob, I know how you are. It will hurt him to see you like this. And you can't fool him. You know how he is. He knows when you're drinking and doing drugs. And he did. He could tell on the other end of the phone when I was high. I mean, I was like weird. I mean, like I think I'm real straight and debonair and everything. And he says, you're doing that stuff again. How does he know that, right? And I knew she was right. I said, I got to see him. She said, you can't go over there high. It'll hurt him. I said, Mom, I promise you I'll go tomorrow. If you tell me I can go, I'll go tomorrow and I will not have a drink. I swear to you, I will not have a drink. She said, you promise you can't go in? I said, I promise you, Mom, I will not have a drink. And the next morning I came to on that couch and I'm shaking. And I'm thinking about my need to go see my father, but I'm also thinking about walking down the halls of that hospital. You see, I got hair down to about here, and I got a long beard, and I don't bathe regular, and I got shabby clothes on. I don't do laundry. I have this paranoid, terrorized feeling of they're going to be looking at me as I walk through that hospital, and I can't face it. I can't do it. And I think to myself, I start having this conversation with myself. If you're an alcoholic, you're having a conversation with yourself, you're screwed. You're done. It's just a bad deal. And I'm having this conversation with myself. And the conversation is, well, I'll get a half pint of vodka. You can't smell vodka on your breath. I'll drink that just enough to take the deal out of it. I'll eat some of those Hall's cough drops. The guy I'm living with has a bottle of Aramis in his bathroom. I'll throw a little bit of that on. You won't know I'm high. I'm not talking about drunk here. I'm talking about just to take the shakes away, for God's sakes. And the problem is that I have a delusion about how much control I got, right? And I start drinking. Well, I go to the liquor store, and it just seemed like a real bad waste of money to get a half pint when for just not much more, you can get a fifth, and I'd have some when I came back from the hospital. Because it was going to be a grueling experience going to that hospital. I'd have some when I get back from the hospital. The problem is I start drinking, and every drink I've ever taken my whole life leads me to a feeling of one more, and one more, and one more. And the next thing I know, I'm too drunk to go see my father. And I'm sitting there as I'm sinking into oblivion, swearing to myself with tears in my eyes, full of self-pity. Tomorrow, I'm not going to drink and I'm going to go see my dad. Tomorrow came and the same thing happened. I never got to see my father in that hospital. And if you think I didn't love my father, you're crazy. That's alcoholism. When it says powerless, I'm telling you, there's not a loved one. There's not a thing hanging over your head. You can't be threatened by prison if you're like me. All it'll do is maybe buy you a few months. If you have alcoholism like I got alcoholism, you got one hope, and that's to surrender, absolutely. And yet, if you're wired like me, everything in me fights that. To this day. And I got lucky, and I was in that hospital in 1978, and I got this guy to sponsor me, and I started following him around, and I went to 15 or 20 meetings a week. I still go to a lot. Next week I'll be 29 years sober. I still go to probably 8 or 10 a week. Somebody told me not too long ago, he said, you don't really need to go to quite that many, do you? I said, you might be right, but I'll tell you, I'd rather go to one or two too many than that one or two not enough. That one or two not enough is a deadly proposition. And I will not allow myself to have a minimalist approach towards my life. I mean, if you had a best friend that you loved, wouldn't you want, and he had a chance, he was dying of a terminal illness. I sat with a guy today I love very much who's given a very slim chance of living through the rest of for another year. And he's going after everything. He's going after the spooky cures. He's going after the radiology. He's going after, he's in. He says, it's not enough that I surrender the fact that I'm dying. He says, I got to surrender to that I want to live. And if you had someone you loved, wouldn't you want them to go after this thing with everything in them? And yet, isn't it funny? You'd want that for your best friend, but you won't do it for you. You won't buy the same level of involvement in your own recovery. I guess, isn't that an indication, if you're like me and you catch that in yourself, it started telling me that I probably care more about other people than I really care about myself. And when I got very lucky when I was new, I started doing 12-step work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started sponsoring people. And I started caring about the old-timers. I wanted their approval so much. I wanted to be like them. They had something I didn't have. And I've never been anywhere in my life where you could take all the pathetic, weak defects of my character and use them to save my life. And that's exactly what happened here. My fear of what you thought of me, you used that to get me involved in Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I never would have gotten involved if I wasn't afraid of what the old-timers thought and wanted their approval and afraid I wouldn't get it. If I wasn't afraid of alcoholism, if I didn't want everything, everything that was negative inside of me seemed to be used for my benefit here. And I guess I don't really know. You don't really know. I know I'm lucky. I'm blessed. I think sometimes lucky is just a God's grace remaining anonymous. You know, I'm very fortunate to survive this thing. And yet, we live in a day and age where most people die of alcoholism, and no one has to. No one has to. But it's the only disease. You can't treat a guy against his will. The desire for change and recovery and surrender must come from within. I get to go day after tomorrow down to see some friends of mine and hang out with my sponsor. He'll be celebrating 49 years of sobriety. A man who I'm glad is in my life. I have another guy that's almost 51 years sober that I talk to twice a week, who is the guy I'd like to be when I grow up. 51 years sober, and he still does about 15 meetings a week and goes into the jails and the detoxes. He's my hero. I have those people in my life. I have my peer group. I have the guys that are sober between 25 and 35 years that I'm like this with, that I love. They're my peer group that I run with, and then I have the guys that I sponsor and the newer guys. And sometimes those groups interchange. Sometimes guys are fine. Sometimes some of those guys are in all three groups, you know. And I just love Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat today with a bunch of guys, and I sat and I realized two things. I realized there's not one person inside or outside of AA that I have a problem with. That's not podium talk. There's some people that do some things that I think are a little silly, but it's okay. I mean, I've done some sillier crap than that. I mean, we all get our turn. I'm a knucklehead on Tuesday, you're Wednesday, you're Thursday. I mean, we all get our turn, right? You know why sometimes I see guys that I love do knucklehead stuff? It's not because I don't judge them harshly. I know that they're going to reap the same thing for the knucklehead behavior that I reap. And it's just a little part of me just is sad. You got to do that to my friend here. And I guess maybe God must feel the same way when I do that to me, I suppose. When I'm the knucklehead. I looked at all those guys that I was with today, and I realized how much I love them all. I realized that maybe that is one of the great, next to my sobriety, very well may be the very great gift of my sobriety, is that always had a capacity to judge, but I never had a capacity to love. And I mean unconditionally. See, I was too consumed with me and myself and all that stuff to really care about other people. I was too afraid of you, too afraid of what you thought of me, too afraid, too many secrets that I didn't want you to know about. I was too defended, and I don't, I can, I don't, I'm not that guy anymore. I could be, I suppose, but I'm very, very fortunate today in Alcoholics Anonymous. Even with all the self-centered, empty, vacant, driving defects of character that I came here with, that I have been able to survive those. I stopped drinking, picked up other addictions, you know, gambling and just spending and just sex. And I mean, I remember the one point I was at a retreat and the guy said, "Aren't you excited to wonder what next year's obsession will be?" You know, right. But after a while, you get like the rat. I don't want any more cheese. I just want out of the trap. I just think I'm going to go help new people. Thank you. Right? That hurts. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You may not have identified with me. A lot of people don't. They really don't. But you know something? Next week, there's going to be somebody here that'll probably light you up. Because we've got a wrench for every nut in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for my life.